Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC, offering surgical care for the brain, spine, and peripheral nerves. More information can be found at upmc.com/centralpaneuro.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. 10 people were killed in a mass shooting at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, Saturday. The victims were black, and investigators say the shooter was motivated by racial hatred. The Buffalo mass shooting was one of several nationwide this past weekend. For many years, criminologists Jillian Peterson and James Densley have studied mass shootings and the people who carry them out. Their research has shown, and they point out in their 2021 book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic, is that those who carried out mass shootings share four common characteristics, including grievances and exposure to violence. What you'll hear today is from a conversation with Dr. Peterson and Dr. Densley last year on Smart Talk. You have a database, as we said, for every mass shooting since 1966. You found that there were four commonalities amongst the shooters. What are those commonalities, Dr. Densley?
So the first thing that we saw in the life histories of these shooters was early childhood trauma. And in some ways, that feels intuitive because it lays a foundation for perhaps what comes later. Now, a lot of people experience trauma early in life. It doesn't mean that they're going to become a mass shooter. But what we did see is really terrible stories of abuse and neglect in the lives of these individuals. So that's the first piece. The second is they all reach an identifiable crisis point in their lives. It's essentially the straw that breaks the camel's back, and it usually festers as some sort of grievance where they feel like there's somebody out there to blame for what is happening in their lives, whether it's a loss of a job or the loss of a relationship. But the really striking thing about that crisis point, and this is perhaps the most important piece, is it's often a suicidal crisis. And so we then start to think of mass shootings as being someone's final act. And that really changes how you go about preventing mass shootings when you think about it from a deterrence or a prevention standpoint. The third factor is mass shooters study other mass shooters. And there is a cultural script for this type of violence within American society. We've seen it in the news media. We've seen it on television. We see it on social media. And when people are looking for understanding in their lives, models of behavior, they go searching for them. And they don't have to look very far, unfortunately, because there's been so many mass shootings in the past. So they study other mass shooters. That kind of radicalizes them into this type of violence. And then the final thing is opportunity. So you need to have access to the people and places where these shootings are going to occur. And of course, you need access to firearms in order to perpetrate a mass shooting. So those are the four steps: childhood trauma, a crisis point, often a suicidal crisis, this kind of cultural script for the violence, and then finally, opportunity.
I notice you didn't mention mental illness. We've talked about that a little bit. We mentioned it a little bit earlier in our conversation that often after these mass shootings, as you said, there is a script for the mass shooter, as well as how the media handles it, how the public handles it, how government handles it. And one of the two things we hear most often is that this person was going through a mental illness crisis or was mentally ill. And the other blame point is guns. But I noticed, Dr. Densley, you didn't mention mental illness.
Yeah, I didn't mention mental illness. That's because we can say that anybody who perpetrates a mass shooting is obviously not living their most full life, and they're not perhaps very well. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're ill, mentally ill. We actually ran the numbers on this. One of the hardest things to sort of disentangle when you think about mental illness is to what extent is mental illness truly driving someone's behavior and truly driving what they do, like a mass shooting, for instance. So you may even have a diagnosable mental illness, but that doesn't mean that everything you do every day, 24/7, is driven by that mental illness. So the easiest way to disentangle this was to look at something like psychosis. So if you are experiencing delusions and hallucinations that may be driving you toward violence, what we found in our research is that only in about 10% of the mass shooters in our database was psychosis the true driving motivation for the violence that followed. In all other cases, we were seeing lots of other things that were going on in people's lives as well. And I think there's two important takeaways from this. Number one is we don't want to stigmatize mental illness and make it sound like everybody who perpetrates a mass shooting has a mental illness, because there's so many people in the world living with mental illness. There's so many different types of mental illnesses that they get conflated. And then I think the other piece is that this is a complicated picture. And so it's not just about that diagnosable illness. It's also about poverty. It's also about frustrations at work. It's also about the argument that you had with your girlfriend. There's lots of other things that are going on in people's lives that can be compelling them toward violence. And it's not easy just to put it in one box and then sort of explain it away with mental illness.
Dr. Peterson, I'll address this to you. Dr. Densley just talked about mental illness as part of this. But you, the two of you have broken this down even further with different types of mass shooters. School shooters, for example, have their own characteristics or own commonalities. Those who are, conducted a mass shooting at a college or university had theirs. Workplace shooters had theirs. It seems as though school shooters, let's talk about school shooters first. Those are the ones that seem to get the most publicity. But let's talk about school shooters. What are some of the commonalities, if you will, or characteristics of school shooters?
Sure. Perpetrators of school shootings tend to be 15 to 16 years old white males who are current students of the school, which is really important when we're thinking about prevention. They are typically young men who are depressed, who are actively suicidal, and who are studying other perpetrators of mass shootings, namely the Columbine case.
What about college and university shooters? It does seem as though most of those perpetrators, or more of those perpetrators, maybe I should say, that mental illness is part of that.
And that's true. So college and university shooters tend to be, again, students of that college or university, which tends to be a large public university. They tend to be non-white. They are more likely to experience psychosis or serious mental illness. And they're also more likely to leave behind what we call a legacy token, a manifesto, something that people will read and look at after they commit their horrible crime that will kind of live on.
Mm. Workplace shooters, what about them?
Yeah, workplace shooters are a little bit different. Their crimes tend to be a little bit less planned. Typically, the triggering event is either being fired or suspended or reprimanded. Firing is most common. They're about 50% white, 50% black. They tend to be older, like in their 40s, and they tend to use a handgun that they legally own.
I know I'm going to be jumping around on you with this, but Dr. Densley, when you talked about those four characteristics, you say exposed to violence or abuse. Now, you're not just talking, and the word exposed is what I'm picking out here. When you're talking about exposed to violence, you're not just talking about video games or movies. What do you mean when you're talking about exposed to violence?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think one of the big myths about mass shootings is that it is violent video games that is to blame for the whole phenomenon. I've often said if that were true, then you'd have the most amount of mass shootings in Japan, because they play plenty of video games there in that part of the world. So when we mean exposure to violence, it's often an intimate exposure to violence. So it is that the perpetrators of mass shootings perhaps are themselves victims of violence earlier in their life. That could be domestic violence. It could be sexual violence. It could be bullying later in life as well. So we see them as having that victimization experience early in life. The other exposure as well, when I said it's very intimate, is that they are witnesses to violence, often in the home. So we see domestic violence in the home is quite common. And we've even had cases where there's been parental suicide that the eventual perpetrators of mass shooters have been exposed to as children. And I think the point with this is, again, there are millions of people across the world who get exposed to violence, particularly domestic violence, who never go on to perpetrate a mass shooting. But what we see in the lives of these individuals is they are exposed to that type of violence, but then they don't get the support and the care and the help that they need. And it sort of builds over time with a number of other factors that then result in the outcome that we see later on.
Dr. Peterson, along those lines, the two of you in the book point out that relationships are important, that most often, I mean, and this almost sounds too simple when we say they need someone to talk to, but that may be too simple of an explanation. But having some type of support, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a teacher to talk to, whether it is another relative to talk to, that these mass shooters tend to not have that kind of support or those kind of relationships.
Yeah, and this was the piece that was surprising and gave me actually a lot of hope, is that when we would talk to perpetrators who were in prison, incarcerated the rest of their lives, and we would say, is there anything or anyone that could have stopped you? Every single time they said yes. And so I think we can get, you know, caught up in the big policy conversations that we need to have around guns and around access to mental health care and around trauma screening. But also, when someone is at the brink and they are depressed and they're suicidal and they're angry and they've been radicalized and they're collecting weapons, sometimes someone just stepping in, carving out the space to connect with them and give them a tiny piece of hope can actually get them through that crisis moment that they're in. And we talked to people that we call kind of almost perpetrators who were planning a shooting, one that even went to the school with the gun in his backpack and changed his mind because of that human connection.
Something you just touched on as well is that most shooters give signals ahead of time or tell someone ahead of time that this is something that they're planning or thinking about, Dr. Densley.
Yeah, that's right. The sort of technical term for it, and it's not that technical, is they call it leakage, in as much that the information is spilling out of the individual. And this is a very common thing that we see in the histories of the mass shooters. And one of the key takeaways, I think, and we write about this a lot in the book, is that we need to be attuned to what those warning signs are. And sometimes I think we get caught up in this idea that we're looking for threatening behaviors, but it's not necessarily always a threatening behavior that is indicative of actually the underlying struggle that that person is experiencing. So what it really is just a case of us looking out for one another. It's recognizing when someone's struggling, when they're in crisis, and then getting them connected to what they need. The big takeaway for us in the research was there are barriers to getting people connected. So one of them is that we just don't take the warning signs at face value, that we don't believe them, or we don't want to be a snitch, or we don't want to get people in trouble. I think part of the reason for that is because we have really defaulted to law enforcement as being the first and only line of defense on this issue. And people are thinking, well, I don't really want to call the police on my own child or on my best friend, but I know they need help. So what do I do? So we've got to make it a lot easier to report, but we've also got to make it so that the response is not always punitive. Because if we're just going to exclude our way or discipline our way or arrest our way out of this problem, that's not going to work. So we need those viable alternatives, and we need everybody looking out for one another, knowing those signs, so that you can reach in and say, something's not right here. Let me talk to you. Let me see what's going on in your life. But we're not going to punish you for that because you've not done anything yet.
That was a conversation from a Smart Talk last year with criminologist Jillian Peterson and James Densley, authors of the 2021 book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.